News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every weekend right here. Each week we visit with veterans of World War II. We want them to know how much we appreciate what they've done for our country. We want to honor them for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, of course, we're educated quite a bit and maybe even inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. You've heard me talk a lot lately about honor flight, and our guest today, E.T. Roberts of Bakersfield, California, recently returned from that emotional trip to the World War II Memorial thanks to Honor Flight Kern County. His 93-year-old brother went on an honor flight as well. There is nothing I'd love more than to see every veteran who wants to go back and see his memorial get that opportunity. It is Father's Day weekend, and of course, most of the veterans I end up talking to on Hometown Heroes are fathers. For many of us, we wouldn't be here if our fathers or grandfathers didn't make it home from the war. And let's take a detour down that road quickly before we go back in time here. Bakersfield Centennial High School recently saw baseball coach Randy Roberts retire after 13 league titles and 3 section championships in 20 years. If you're listening on the Central Coast and remember big leaguer Brent Morrell when he played for Cal Poly, well, he also played for Coach Randy Roberts. If you're a Fresno State fan and you loved watching Dusty Robinson, he played for Randy Roberts. But there would be no Coach Randy Roberts if his father, the man we're going to hear from today, did not survive some incredibly treacherous days with the 29th Infantry Division. That includes the longest day, June 6th, 1944. We're going to get to all of that. Let's start off early on. Let's go all the way back to Oklahoma and Cherokee Nation. You were 7 kids in a family out there in Oklahoma?
Yes, that's right. I was drafted 18 years old, went in, and I went to Texas. I went from Camp Walters, Texas, to Camp Shanks, New York, and from New York to England, and that's where I trained 17 months for the invasion of Europe.
And you were in on the beginning of the invasion. Before you got drafted, I'm sure you weren't thinking, hey, I'm going to be overseas fighting in a war. I'm sure you had your own aspirations and dreams there growing up in Oklahoma.
I was a painter, training as a painter, and I boxed in the Golden Gloves, and also I boxed when I went into the service at Camp Walters, Texas. I won Camp Walters, Texas championship boxing there before I left Walters, Texas there. I just had a very short time there, and they moved us to make that invasion.
And is it fair to say that your skill in boxing came from having 4 brothers and being one of 7 siblings? You got plenty of practice fighting?
It could be. That was every day in school. I like to fight, so I fought in school and fought all brothers and everyone else. I like to fight, and I guess that's the reason they put me in the infantry and sent me into combat like that. I was a pretty tough little boy that I always thought I was till I might have got softened up a little bit in the war.
And you said when you were 18, you were drafted. You turned 18 just a couple weeks after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. What do you remember about December 7th, 1941? Do you remember how you found out about it?
I had just heard it on the radio. All I didn't find out about it and saw pictures about it, but I never knew that much about it, but I was ready to go and see what we could do about things like that. You know, I was ready to go into the service. But my brother, he done volunteered, went in, and so that's the reason I wanted to go in and see if we could get together. We was a little ways apart one time there in France, and I was in France, and he was in Italy. He was in Salerno and through that part of it there, and I was in the other part. He was under General Patton, and I was under Eisenhower.
Let me backtrack just a little. You mentioned something. Before you went overseas, you were the boxing champion of Camp Walters, Texas. Did that take a lot of bouts to earn that title?
I had 3 fights. I had to fight 3 before I got to the last fight I had, the camp championship, was the time before that I drawed him, and that's who I had to whip to. So I was the camp champ, but I got moved out. I didn't get to stay there and defend my championship.
I'm just wondering if we had Mr. Let's Get Ready to Rumble say, in this corner, 90-year-old E.T. Roberts, if you'd step out in the ring and take somebody on now.
I'll fight anyone my age.
Even your big brother?
My big brother. I'll take him on. I think that'd be easy bout, though, myself, so I'd rather have one some tougher than that.
I'm going to have to go interview your brother now and get his story now that you laid down the gauntlet like that. So I get the sense that you were a pretty confident guy. Obviously, if you're a boxing champion, you have to feel pretty good about your own abilities. So as they trained you and they shipped you off to England for more training, what were your expectations? What were you looking forward to?
I've always had it in my system, in my heart and soul. I was very small. And I was a 3-pound baby when I was born, and I've always been small. But I had it always in my heart and the soul that any big guy could do something, I could do part of it if I couldn't do the same thing he could do. And I never did think anyone could whoop me that ever lived. I mean, I had that going into the war. And I've met school teacher after I came back, and he said, I know being in school, how I had to paddle you for fighting. He said, I know that you give them a bad time, and I certainly did.
I can imagine. So we're going to get to June 6, 1944. I know that's a day that you can never forget. But you mentioned 17 months in England training for this. What kind of stuff did you do?
That's amphibious training, going off of boats and hitting the beach and running and digging holes and getting ready for combat. That's really what it was all about.
And you're with the 29th Infantry Division.
115th Infantry, Company C.
In the training, I've heard different stories from different people. One of the big stories that's been told about that preparation time in England was a disaster they had in Operation Tiger at Slapton Sands, where they were practicing a landing and the Germans actually came up and fired on him. Were you involved in that?
No, I wasn't involved in that. Only problems we ever had, was working with the British, and the British was dropping the ramp on some of our boys and killing them. We'd go in on the beach, and he hauled the ramp down, and he said, no, the ramp's stuck. We'd have to go over the top of it to go in, and by the time one of them went over the top of it, the ramp came down and killed him. Well, we had a kind of time about that. Until we told them the next and we'll open fire on you. And we got that settled, so the ramp got down from then on.
Yeah, I guess that would get my attention, especially from someone with your reputation for toughness. Well, and I guess the other question that comes to mind, 17 months, here's this Oklahoma boy over in England for 17 months just waiting for something to happen. What'd you do to pass all the time? You didn't get in any trouble at night over in England, did you?
Yeah, I did. Me and one of my buddies, just before we were interviewed to make that beachhead, we got a little furlough and we went down in England there. I mean, not a little furlough, it was just a night. And we went to a pub in there and we was in there drinking coffee, but we'd been drinking in the pub before that, drank a little bit of their Guinness or pale ale, whatever they call it. We got in a big fight in there, tore up the building and everything, and we had to go home and dig foxholes for 3 days. After that, every day they made us dig foxholes for the destroying that pub.
Did you learn your lesson?
No.
An honest man, we can ask for nothing more. So as this time goes by, obviously you guys know you're over there for a reason, and someday this invasion is going to come, right?
Yes, we did. They knew us there, but when they interviewed us, we were the assistant salt. We were to hit Omaha 820 D-Day with the assistant salt, we were told. And they said there'd be bomb craters on the beach when we trained. And I trained with the rifle and flamethrower, too. I had a flamethrower when I hit the beach. And I went off the ramp, and I never did touch bottom. And I turned the flamethrower loose. And I had a soldier behind me that had my full field pack. I had a lot of good stuff in my pack, in my bedding, my eats, and everything in that pack. And he had my rifle. He's supposed to go off the same time as me behind me. And as soon as I got rid of that flamethrower, give me my rifle and stuff and let me go. But I've never seen that boy yet today. I don't know whatever happened to all that crew, but I had turned that flamethrower loose. It's going to drown me. and the tide was so high it come up under my helmet like it broke my neck. And I had to lay there on the beach until I got my neck straightened up. I crawled over and got a rifle from a soldier that was wounded there, or dead. I'm sure he's dead because I see his entrails and stuff laying out on the ground that were strapped on what I disintegrated him almost. Anyway, I got up on the beach and went up on the hill, and all I ever saw of my whole company was seven of us left. I don't know whatever happened to the rest. I've never seen them yet today. And then when we went into combat, I got wounded about 29 days after I got into combat at St. Lo. And I went out, and when I came back into combat, they didn't send me back to my company. They sent me back to 116th. And I went to Brest. And that was well fortified and started to taking soldiers up to the front and placing them and everything, and had a few problems. Got court-martialed and everything in there for telling the colonel that I was going to shoot him, but because he called me Yellow Belly. He told me to move up some soldiers 700 yards, and I moved up the squad to 700 yards, and I went back in a little bit to check them. He said, come back and report it when you get a place. I went back and reported it, and then I went back up. There were seven of them dead, and one that I kind of thought quite a bit of. He was laying there, and his leg was blown off. He just had it laid up over his head, and he said, Sergeant, he said, take this leg off of me. And I caught a hold of his sock. There wasn't no shoes. Shoes was blown off. And I broke down and went back and kind of give the lieutenant a piece of my mind. He didn't like it, and he sent me to the company CP, which is just a little ways back there. And I went back and I threatened the lieutenant colonel back there that when he called me Yellow Belly, he said, well, what's about that? He said, that you Yellow Belly? And I said, no, you're the Yellow Belly. Being back here, I ought to go out there and get my gun. I had my gun sitting outside of the tent that he was in. And I said, I should shoot you. So I got court-martialed, busted from staff sergeant down to private, which I didn't care. I mean, stripes is nothing. There wasn't nothing else. But to get that over with and get home. So I finished up all the way through with the 116th Infantry. Went to Belgium, Holland, all the way back to Germany. And I stayed in Bremen, Germany. Took some time there that some soldiers was in there, was married and had families. I stayed and let them come home because of had the families. And I stayed over there and pulled kind of little MP duty, and we had to move all the Russians and Polish and move them other people out there where the Germans could have their homes that they'd come in there and take. And when I left there, the Germans would have hugged us and kissed us and asked us to stay, not to ever leave there. And we had very good relations with the Germans, and I think they're very, very good people yet today. It's just some nut gets something to going and spreads big, like the Nazi business and stuff like that. So we finished the job anyway, and that's what I'm proud of today, that we did finish our job.
Yeah, and you were in on the beginning of it, at least in Europe, and you just gave us a great overview of your whole experience there. And I know it's not easy to talk about all of it, but I want to ask you a few more questions about that. As you're heading toward Omaha Beach and you're on that landing craft, I imagine the big picture of everything you could see in every direction was something that you've never seen again since. What did it look like as you were approaching that beach?
When I was sitting out there, we were hit June 5th. We were supposed to hit the 5th, and the tide was so high that we couldn't go in. We had to sit out there, and you could step from ship to ship that was taking soldiers in there, and you couldn't see nothing across that ocean as far as you could see, with ships and stuff going in to make the invasion in there. And we went in the next June 6th, the next day. All of us was seasick, but when you say ramp down, you got to get off. You can't turn back. You got to go. So we had to go. And when you hear people today say, I'm sick, I can't go to work, think about something like that and see how that fixed. When they dump you off over there, seasick and nothing to eat, we had to stay out there days longer than we had to, and the boat was full of vomit and stuff that way. It really was. It was a mess. So that's what we went through with. And then it was 9 days before we ever got any good clothes to put on. We hit that salt water and stuff. You can imagine what our feet and stuff was.
And I want to ask you, as you hit that water, you described for us having that flamethrower on, and this is a big, heavy thing that you're going to wear on your back, 72 pounds of equipment there. And you come off that ramp, you're expecting your feet are going to hit bottom, but you just kept sinking?
Well, they told us and said, unbuckle your chin straps because the tide will come up under your helmet. And I didn't unbuckle my chin strap. The flamethrower I thought would help me too. But the flamethrower is what took me down so fast that tide came up under and hurt my neck. It broke my neck, I guess. And since I came home in civilian life, I'd had two discs replaced in my neck and everything.
It's not exaggerating to say that you nearly died just coming off the landing craft.
Oh, sure. I'm lucky to be here today. Yeah.
Well, and I think we all feel fortunate to be able to listen to your story today. E.T. Roberts of Bakersfield, California, a recipient of the Purple Heart and the Bronze Star, and a man who will share even more detail about Omaha Beach on D-Day when Hometown Heroes continues right after this.
They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need a thousand words, just two of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, two more. Ming's Restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you two more. Las Banas. That's where I grew up. And I'm guessing Las Banas is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Cito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just got to go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Las Banas, California.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today has been in Bakersfield, California for close to 70 years now. He's originally from Oklahoma. In fact, he's part Cherokee, and he's all survivor. Wait until you hear what he went through in the 29th Infantry Division in Europe. When we left off, E.T. Roberts had nearly drowned on his way ashore on D-Day, June 6th, 1944. You got rid of that flamethrower on your back, hurt your neck in the process. You never saw that other soldier who was carrying the rest of your equipment. So you're arriving on Omaha Beach pretty much empty-handed into one of the most dangerous, destructive, devastating scenes the world has ever known.
People could never, I can't even understand myself how I ever lived through the smoke and gunfire. He said you couldn't hear nothing. It was the smoke, it was strangly, it was so thick, gun smoke. Just shell after shell and a big facing a cannon sitting inside of a wall that was far and out there and nothing. I saw little LCVPs come in there, not one soldier get off of it. That shell, the way they had it, big, the gun emplacement, they said had 4 foot of cement in it and sitting in the walls, just like going into a side of a house and look out the windows. The gun placements looked like that to me. I could see them far and all out of there. I told the guy on the Marine or sailor, whatever he was on the ship, I said, open fire on him. Open fire on that guy there. And he was so scared he run off the top. I don't know where he ever went to. That's when we was going in, I could see that firing was taking place there. But when I got out on the beach and I got straightened up and got up off of the beach, I met about 7 people from the same company I didn't know, even hardly. Got me a rifle and stuff and went on through there. And then I got wounded in St. Louis. I got changed from first scout to a squad leader, and we were completely replaced 9 times. So when they start to ask me, telling me names and stuff, I finally got to where I'm just going to call you soldier. And that's about the way I think today. People tell me names, and I can't think of names. I think of stuff like that, that so many names came and said, well, this is so-and-so, this so-and-so, and maybe 30 minutes he'd be not there. I've seen him last about 30 minutes in combat, and that's about it.
Certainly there on June 6th, and it's been called the longest day for a really good reason, especially the part of it you were in.
I couldn't get off of there. I was sick and had to lay there, and I got my neck straightened up, and that water was solid blood. I mean, it was just like a bloodbath going through it there. The beach, you couldn't walk without stepping on a dead soldier. You crawled and made your way around through there to get off of the beach, and finally I did. Got off the beach. I don't know. Some people say, how long did it take you to get off the beach? I don't know. And I don't think anybody else would. There's so much going on and everything that you don't, you couldn't even tell anybody your name, probably.
So it's definitely loud. I'm sure the smell was horrific. Obviously, what you're seeing is something that no one has ever seen or experienced before. And I'm just trying to imagine myself in your shoes. How did you keep going? Weren't you scared to death?
You're past scared. You don't even know who you're at or what you're doing. Think about fighting day and night. 27 days without ever coming off of the front line. And the only way it got you off is to get shot. And then... I was out 26 days back into combat. Went back to England and patched me up and sent me back into combat.
Another thing you mentioned about D-Day, you talked about finding seven other guys from your company. For people who aren't familiar with how that works, how many people were in your company to begin with? How many from your company were supposed to hit that beach?
200 and something soldiers there in the company. I never did see any of the boys, lieutenant or nobody. I never seen no one after that. So I don't know where the bunch of them went. One good friend that I did meet him, and he went in with me there. And last time I saw him, he had his heel shot off. We hit the ground, machine gun fire came up. He didn't put down his feet flat like you're supposed to turn your feet out flat. He stuck his heels up, he put his toes to the ground, and he shot his heels off, and I went over and talked to him a little bit, and I said, well, I got to go. We was moving at that time, and I had to go on, and we was trying to run them people out of there, and that's, I don't know whatever happened to that boy. It's just one of them things that happens in combat. I had another friend came in there that I knew, got acquainted with from Oklahoma boy, Donald Crawford. He, the artillery shell was coming over. And I told him, I said, get your whole artillery. You can hear artillery coming over. And I said, go get your hole. And I don't know why he did, but he put a piece of tin over his hole. When he started to go down the hole, a piece of tin caught him on right above his forehead, just scalped him almost. I don't know whatever happened to that boy either. Things like that happens in combat.
Yeah, and we know what happened to you. We're going to find out the rest of what happened to you. I wonder, you talk about climbing into your hole, and as that longest day came to a close and you tried to find out if you could actually sleep that night and think about what the future might hold, were you able to sleep? How could you possibly sleep after a day like that?
We don't know when we slept. I mean, I've asked some guys, they know when they slept, but not a combat boy that was in there and hit that beastie day. If they tell me when they slept, I would sure like to talk to them and understand how they would sleep, because I never remember sleeping. I think I sleep with my eyes open. I believe that's the only way we did sleep. And another thing, when you get replacements in that way, and you talk about sleeping, you don't know. The guys you train with, you could trust. I mean, he'd say, well, you go ahead and go to sleep, and I'll pull guard duty while you sleep. But at nighttime, when you set up to get some rest, and you say, okay, you sleep a while, and I'll sleep a while. You go to sleep, you wake up, and he's asleep too. He might have been a butcher or a candlestick maker or whatever. You don't know what they are when they come into combat replacements. They're not trained like we were trained to fight. And it's very scary to be in combat with people like that.
And obviously you had a close call just getting off the Higgins boat, hitting the beach. But for the rest of that day on Omaha Beach, the bloodiest day of that invasion, the bloodiest spot of that invasion, how close did gunfire, artillery, or any of that come to you personally?
I could hear it whistle above my ears. I've heard shells sing beautiful song right beside my ears, bullets and stuff. And just look, when I got wounded, there was one went off my helmet, one hit me in the shoulder, and three went through my field jacket. So, and the flame hit me right in the face. I faced the face with one. And what happened, the kid that was one of the replacements was there. He was hollering at me, said, the soldier said, get this guy off my back. They'd done come over the hedgerow and got on his back, and I turned to get his back, and this one came over the hedgerow with a burp gun and came right down at me, and all I ever saw was flame and fire. And I didn't know I was shot for a while, and I kept trying to get my gun up, my arm with shoulders cramping and everything. And I, blood was running all over me, and I was trying to get my gun up to shoot another what was coming over there. And then I knew that I was finished. So when I started out, I laid down my rifle and walked off. And I got back to the hedgerow behind me, and right at the, I started to go out the gate, there's a German pull down on me again. I thought, well, this is it here. And he saw I was bloody and sick and everything, and he let me go. So I went back, and that's when I had to go to England and patch me up.
Wow. And this is another one of those I want to ask you a few more questions about. Hold on. You know what? I think so. This is at near St. Lo, and this is how long after D-Day? This is a few weeks later, about a month later?
28 days.
And you hadn't been off the front lines at all during this whole time?
I had not. I've been right on the front line all the time. Yeah.
I have to imagine you were exhausted.
Well, I don't know if you'd ever get tired or not. We were trained. We were really, really was trained. And that's one thing about the, I can say, C Company that we trained there in England, 25-mile hikes, full field pack, and all that many and many a day and out on the amphibious training. That what's one thing about it, we was in shape, and they had us all so mad that they'd clean us up. And Eisenhower and Montgomery, General Montgomery, that's a British big shot. Anyway, they lined us up and told us, well, we're going on parade, Eisenhower and them. We're going to parade by. This was about 4 or 5 days before the invasion was made. We went by Eisenhower and them. There's us standing on a platform beside the road there in England after we went 25-mile hike. And he said, man, he said, take them down there. It's a slough down, not too far from there. That you know, everybody knows what a slough is. It's old, muddy, nasty, new water and stuff. He said, run them through that and then bring them back through. They took us and run us through the slough and brought us back through there and said, now then, they look like combat soldiers. And we went home and had to work 5 or 6 hours getting ourselves all cleaned back up because you had to come back out the next morning with shined up, cleaned up, ready to go again. And that's the kind of stuff they would put on you, I guess, to get your madness up or get whatever they want to get up to ready to fight. And you could believe that you are ready to go when you take that type of training. You go into something that way that you're ready to do something and get out of what you're doing. That's the reason that the combat soldiers, there's so many of them lost and everything, that they had a terrible, terrible time of training for that.
So here you are. You've been on the front lines basically for a month, and you're in St. Lo, and you talk about this burp gun and people who maybe haven't seen one before. I mean, this is an automatic rifle, Schmeisser, that the Germans had that could fire rounds so fast.
Great little grease guns. There's like our little Thompson subs, they call them.
Yep.
And that's exactly what they are, although they're a little smaller. And they will spit some rounds out at you, yes.
So fast that they could literally saw you in half.
Oh, yes, yes. He thought he had it to center me, but he had it to side of me, luckily. And I was trying to punch another guy off of one's back there, and I'm sure that I got him off of there, but I don't know about this. The guy was shooting me of what I done to him. Or
how far away was he from you?
He was in slapping distance.
So from point blank range, he's firing this gun that can pump out multiple rounds a second, and five of them hit you?
The fire was just blinded me. I mean, it was so close to me that he's right in my face, and I didn't have. In fact, he's further than my gun would reach, even closer to me. And he just cut me to right down me. I could got to him with the gun. I could have punched him with my gun or something. But
it sounds like you were in a bit of shock.
Well, I guess I was, because there was so much going on. I was trying to help somebody, and then it all jumps on to me. When they start coming over the hedger on top of you, too, well, then you got to start doing something for yourself, and you're kind of off guard a little bit. That's the reason, I guess, the only reason I got out of that I always wanted to help other people or do things.
Well, it kind of sounds like someone somewhere must have been helping you, too.
I think God had a great hand in it, helping me, because I never was afraid. I always thought that I would be taken care of, and that's what I feel today, that God has a big hand, and he's not finished with what he wants me to do. And that's something I want to do, is whatever he asked me to do today, I want to do it.
Amen. It sounds, I didn't live it, you did, and I'm trying to imagine it, but it sure sounds pretty miraculous that you survived that, a burp gun from that close range.
Well, if it had been in the center of me, I wouldn't have, but the way it was, in my shoulder, in my arm, and off my helmet and everything, through my field jacket, it didn't get no part of me, and in no other part but just that part, which that's the reason I had to go out and then come back in combat. They have to go through that to swab it out and clean it, because when you get shot through your shoulders or wherever you get shot, it takes material, whatever it is you got on, that it takes it in there, and they have to go in there and clean that out.
Or you can get infected pretty easy.
You get infected. That's what they have to watch for a few days, gunfire. It gets infected very fast.
And there was another thing that you said when telling that story, that call it the hand of God or whatever, but you said another German saw you, had a shot at you, and didn't take it.
Standing one hedgerow back behind us, already ready that far back. I didn't know they got behind us that far. And when I started through the gate, they just got openings to every hedgerow, like where a wagon or whatever can go through there. And when he pulled down on me, I thought, well, that's it. I was walking pretty close there. And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and he let me go. But I didn't have a gun or anything, and he saw I was all bloody, and I don't guess I was walking too good, I don't know. But I know I was really a bloody and smell. It was made me sick. The blood smell made me sick. So they flew us back. They got us on a plane, flew us back across there. They've done set up enough where they get a plane off for make a little airport there, and they flew us back with litter patients. It was just full of litter patients and wounded soldiers, that plane was. Fly them back to England, put them in the hospital, and go back and get another load. Like they had here in Bakersfield, that C-47 they had in here flying around in Bakersfield here. That's the same one, still had the old hangars and stuff in it. I took that trip around Bakersfield in it, and it still had the hangars and everything that they hang litter patients up in, that plane. And that's what we went from France to England in.
Yeah, and I'm sure that was real neat to get back on a C-47. That was all thanks to Honor Flight as well. One final note on this incident in St. Lo, where you were wounded. And I know there are other times where you saw Germans take American prisoners and just mow them down, just execute them on the spot. And this guy could have done that to you right there. How many times over the years have you thought back on that and been thankful that he didn't?
Well, what they would do to us, too, when we get some soldiers and everything, they'd tell us, you take them to the rear. I don't like to talk about stuff like this, but they say you take them back there and you be back in 15 minutes. You just take them back and shoot them, and then you come back. Things like that, they get out. They'll say, well, you soldiers are honoring all this and that. And, you get a bad name for stuff like that. But that happens in the combat. You don't have any time to take care of them. You can't guard and watch them and then get shot by the others are coming after you. You got to do your thing and go on. It's what you ordered to do. Well, the army's war is a very, very stinking thing to me. Yeah.
No doubt. And those of us who haven't experienced it have a hard time grasping just how awful it must have been and how painful the scars, physical and emotional, remain for veterans who saw the kinds of things E.T. Roberts did in World War II. There's more to the story, and we'll get at that next. You can find some photos of Mr. Roberts if you look for the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And Hometown Heroes will come down the home stretch right after this.
A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, E.T. Roberts, survived Omaha Beach on D-Day with the 29th Infantry Division. You heard about the five rounds from a burp gun at point-blank range. He survived that near St. Lo a month later. He was evacuated to England for medical treatment.
You have this time to recover from your wounds, and then you have to go right back into combat. Did you have a different perspective from that point on? Were you thinking, you know what, I survived this, God's going to carry me through? Or did you think, you know what, I've been hit once, it's probably going to happen again?
When I went back into combat in the breast there, when I reported to the officer, he said, well, I'm going to give you a squad and everything. I said, okay. I said, I'll take them, but I really don't want to. And he said, it's command, you have to take them up, move them up. And I said, well, I've had quite a bit of combat already and everything. And he was a new officer in there. And I said, well, it's pretty rough up there. I said, if you move them up there, they're going to all get killed by artillery. I said, they're sitting right down under a hill there in that submarine fort there. The old underground city, they called it the underground city in there is what they called it. I moved them up there, and then they all got shot, and it didn't stand too good with me because I'd done been through so much already that I just give them a piece of my mind, and they didn't like it very good, but we got it over with anyway, so.
And to clarify that, and you mentioned that earlier about you getting, you know, bucked down in rank back to private because of that. But basically what it was you knew that was going to happen. You saw it coming, and they made you endanger the lives of the guys under you, and that made you angry. Do I have that right?
You got that right. And what I say, we call them 90 days wonders. Officers, it goes in this schooling and takes to be an officer to fight in combat. I think he should go in and train in the combat. I mean, shooting and doing things instead of studying. Combat's not in a book. I mean, that's something that they can't write in a book is combat. I mean, it's knowing how to work in combat. You can't, like Private Ryan, I see that picture as part of that. Yeah. And I couldn't watch it because it's so unreal, because people don't stand up and run in combat straight up. Or you don't run straight into combat. You move around into combat. If you stand straight up, you're going to die. I'll guarantee you that, if you are in combat. And you see some things like that. When you hit the ground, you better hit the ground as low as you can and be ready to pull off some firing and learn how to spread your feet out flat. It's just a lot of things that I see there in pictures that way that can never compete with what we were trained and what we done.
And you made it through the end of the war with the blue and gray of the 29th Infantry Division. Do you remember how you found out that Germany had surrendered? Do you remember what it felt like to find that news?
Well, you know, it wasn't over for us. We had to go in and pull some duty. We had to pull guard duty and everything for the civilians because they didn't know that they'd been occupied with Poland and the Russians and everyone else had done worked in theirself into France and took them people's homes and stuff that we had to run civilian people all back to their countries and stuff. So that's what we had to do. I stayed over there about 2 months doing that.
As if you hadn't done enough already, huh?
Yeah. I was pulling guard duty, you know. And the one thing about it to me is a rotten bunch of people. I mean, the ones that was in that part over in there that we had to clean up and every day and to shine our boots and shine everything up. And I was pulling guard duty on a 5-story building there where we had a building full of them refugees that way. And I'm walking around and around the building and they throw sardines out on top of me down there out the window. And I looked up, I saw what window it was. I just put 8 rounds right back in that window. I could have been court-martialed for that. And after that, one day they put me on guard duty out on the Autobahn going to Berlin on one side of the road to check what was going in or what was coming out. And there's some lady ran up to me and she said, a Marine just robbed me or took my watch and my ring and took my money and everything and said he's going to Berlin. And there was a railroad station about 500 yards away from there. Said he's going to catch that train out of that railroad station over there. She said, could you help me? And I said, well, I can't leave my post here. And my buddy over there, I was on one side of the road and I had a friend was on the other side of the road. And my buddy said, go ahead and go up and help her. Said, I can hold us down until you get back. I went over there and there was a Marine. She said, there he is. He's running. The train pulled in. She said, there he is. He's running about 500-600 yards from me there. She said, that's him over there. So I shot over his head. He didn't stop. I hollered halt at him. He didn't stop. And he kept running. So I said, well, I will stop him. And I pulled down on him and shot him in the hip. Shot him well in the thigh and the leg. And went up to him, we did, when he fell out there. And that lady, she got her watch, rings, and got everything back. And so I took him down, told him to get up and go down and get on this train. And when he started to get on the train, that conductor, whoever that was there, said, no, he's not going to get on this train. So I had to pull a gun on him. I said, yeah, he's going on that train. That guy said, yeah, he is too. So they pulled him on the train. That's the last I ever heard of that. I could have been very well court-martialed real bad for that.
Yeah, this sounds more like the Old West than World War II from some of these stories you're telling. A couple more questions for you. You told us the story of your Purple Heart getting wounded near St. Lo, but I also see on your wall a bronze star. Was there a particular action that they gave you that for?
Well, that's just like... I was the first scout in when we first went in there. I was first scout, and they give me that for being the. I go in there and draw fire, and they give me that bronze star for that.
Yeah, that's a pretty dangerous duty to say the least. And I understand you had a sweetheart back home in Oklahoma. You were hoping to come back to.
Yeah, I got married to a little girl. So
you had to survive all that and get home first.
Yeah, I had marriage of 65 years. I lost her last December, and very happy marriage.
Well, and that's, I know I do this every week with every veteran, but it's really amazing to me. You talked about God having a hand in preserving your life and God having a plan for you. And when you think about your 7 grandkids, your 2 sons, not to mention all the ball players your son has coached at Centennial High. They never would have had him as a coach. You never would have made it back to see your wife again and have this family. And all these last nearly 70 years wouldn't have happened. Have you ever stopped and thought about that and thought how amazing it is you survived everything you came through?
That's why I trust in God to help me through each and every day. It's to get me up and born, get me going. I'm pretty well wore out my back and from carrying flamethrowers, and then I've had two open heart surgeries and five bypasses and everything, and my throat cut, two discs put in there, and God's got work for me to do yet, and I'm going to be around a few days to do it. And that's the reason I give him the praise, that it's such a goodness that he does for me.
Amen. And one of the more recent adventures you got to go on was back to Washington, D.C., thanks to Honor Flight Kern County. You and your brother together on a plane to see the World War II Memorial.
No, my brother had been back the month before me, but my son, maybe Randy, went with me. Yeah, my brother's telling me a little bit about it, but it's a wonderful, wonderful place to see. It really is.
What stood out for you? I know they have every state listed, and you spent some time at Oklahoma and California, I'm sure, but what was the highlight of that experience for you?
Is seeing that World War II museum thing that they have set up for World War II. That brought back the whole war to me. I mean, that I saw so much, so many dead, by up to thousands, and the things that happened that... I don't know how a person can ever live to tell about it. And that's what came through my heart and soul at that time, and that God spared me for this, what I'm doing now.
And I know it's not easy to talk about, and I hear the emotion in your voice, but something tells me that standing in front of that fountain with the backdrop of 4,000 gold stars, each representing 100 Americans who died in the war, that sight had meaning for you.
Yes, it did. It's wonderful, wonderful to see. It's amazing how anyone can do that good things for the people to see, but the young generation, people don't understand what the flag and what God Bless America means. But you go there and they do know what it means. They done had the bomb dropped on them. They know what the shaking up is, what death means. But I think myself a lot of times that everyone should go through that. But no, they couldn't go through it. There's so many that couldn't go through that. But I think if we need to put this in the book in history and stuff. There's World War II and Let's teach it so people understand what World War II is all about.
Well, and I guess that's how we can wrap it up. I mean, I want to thank you for serving our country, for putting your life on the line, and for telling us about it, because I know it's not easy with the things you went through that so many did not see the intensity you did. So if it is in a book, if it is going to be remembered by your kids and your grandkids and great-grandkids, what is it that you most want them to remember about you and all those millions of Americans who went off to war?
That I did my best to get the liberty and get home and see my family and stuff and enjoy life again, which I thank God for giving me these days that he's given me. And my grandkids, I love them all, and I hope to have a few more great days in life. And I have wonderful, wonderful people that I've talked to. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And I think I can speak on behalf of a lot of people in saying that. E.T. Roberts of Bakersfield, California. Boy, a candid and intense conversation this week. I can't imagine going through what he did. I'm sure he's going to have a special Father's Day with his family, and I'm sure you'll take care of your dad if you still have him around. If he's a veteran, how about using Father's Day as another good excuse to thank your dad for serving our country? That's Hometown Heroes this time around, and I'm Paul Leffler reminding you that freedom is not free.